welcome to my new podcast episode, Trust versus Control, a really interesting and maybe controversial topic. Let's do it anyway. So today I'd like to talk about why we feel the need to control, what control actually does to the one who's controlled, and how we can slowly move from control to trust. If you don't know me yet, please let me introduce myself. My name is Britta, and my passion is it to accompany horse people step by step on their journey to a peaceful togetherness with their horses, in which they can create a deep bond without dominance, control, and repetitive exercises, where they can meet their horses at eye level and do fun things together, all while still mastering the daily have-tos. Horses are herd animals by nature, spending half of the day eating, while the other half consists of rest, exercise, sleep, and grooming. They get the security they need from the fact that they are part of a herd. Like us humans, they can naturally feel emotions such as anger, fear, and sadness. However, these emotions are mostly undesirable for us humans because they can pose a danger to us. So all our training methods aim to condition the horse in one way or the other to not show these emotions and to make it more controllable and seemingly more willing to do what we ask. Since this training is often associated with pressure or even physical or mental pain, the horse will react differently to it depending on its character. The sensitive, energetic, more fearful horse will quickly give up and try to do what we ask to avoid pressure and pain. It is a master in what we call mind reading. The strong-minded horse will communicate its discomfort more clearly, resist requests, and depending on the situation, might even try to fight with us. Unfortunately, the strong horses are also more likely to experience the most violence during training, as they don't give up easily, no matter how much pressure is put on them. But at some point, even most of the strong horses will give up. When a sensitive horse submits or a strong horse's will gets broken, they both seem to be the bomb-proof horses we want. But just like with us humans, the suppressed emotions like fear, anger, and helplessness are not gone. Underneath the surface, all the emotions are still there. They just don't get expressed. So the horse shuts emotionally down and will get either sad or depressed, or the horse will become unpredictable and will sometimes, out of the blue, show extreme anger or fear. It might also be that the horse is prone to injuries, and some will even develop a chronic illness. The desire for a controllable, obedient horse is understandable, as control gives us human security. As long as I know my horse is always obedient, I don't have to be afraid that it will do something it shouldn't and might put myself, others, or itself in danger. But of course, in that training, we have to demand obedience at all times, even when it's not about a safety-related situation, and we just want our horse to do something specific without a discussion. For example, to move forward in the gate we asked for, to give the hoofs, or walk into a trailer without hesitation, and much more. Because if you would only be assertive in some situations, but in others that might not be as important to us, then the horse would become unreliable, as it would not know when it's important for us and when a no would be okay. This could lead to the horse refusing to do something that is important and thus become uncontrollable again. This means that if I work with control, then I have to do it always and in all situations to avoid any discussions. The horse cannot be given the opportunity to say no in this training because, as I said, this is not part of the concept because it cannot be controlled anymore. This means that once I ask something, I cannot stop asking this before the horse has done what I ask. For this purpose, we have developed different forms of obedience trainings, all of which have in common to teach us how to maneuver our horse through a resistance. Mostly with pressure, discipline, clarity, uncompromising, but also sometimes the streets. based on this training, there are also a lot of equipment that we can buy, different whips, bits, spurs, and much more. Even the design of the round pen itself, for example, is intended to give the horse no place of hiding or a way out to faster achieve obedience. The goal of this training is, as I said, that the horse learns to always do what I ask and to say yes at anything I ask at any time, ideally within a very short period of time. The idea behind this training is that the horse builds trust through my clear and assertive way of asking, and that it learns that I'm a good, confident, and trustworthy leader, and therefore the horse will feel safe with me. The question now is if this is true and if this kind of training really builds trust, or if there might be another reason for the horse's obedience. The easiest way to answer this for ourselves is to put ourselves in the horse's situation to understand how we would feel if someone treated us in this way in situations where we are afraid or feel overwhelmed, and if this would help us to develop trust in this person. Now, when we create situations, one of them could be one that scares us, and another situation where someone wants to make us do something that we might not want to do or that doesn't make any sense to us. Let's first look at the situation. If someone came to you, maybe your mother, and she would put you on a leash and start asking you to take 2 steps back, then 5 steps forward again, and then 3 steps to the side, and then you should lower your head. Then she would load a big heavy bag on your back and ask you to walk 10 laps in a circle. And if you now say, no, thanks, she would say to you that in that case, you are no longer her daughter or son, and you don't belong to her any longer, and that she doesn't want anything to do with you anymore. That you would then be excluded from the family as well. So then you do your circles, because belonging somewhere is very important to you. Now, let's take a second situation. A friend of yours comes over and wants to do something special that day. And then he has a glorious idea to try out what it would be like to be 10 minutes in a room full of spiders. But you don't like that idea. Once your friend realizes that you don't want to do that, maybe that you're even afraid that one of the big spiders might crawl across your face, he takes a rope and explains to you that you have to do it, that there is no option, and that he wants to see if you can do it. But you are just afraid of spiders and you say no, you don't want that. Now your friend takes a hot iron rod and says that if you don't go into this room voluntarily, that he will really only touch you briefly with this and give you more courage with it to go through it and to realize that it's really not a problem because the spiders don't hurt you and they're really not poisonous. Now you're even more afraid of the hot iron rod and you finally go into this room with the spiders and you stay there until your friend thinks that you're now completely calm and that you accepted that it's really not a dangerous situation. So the next time your mother or your friend comes over to visit you because they really like spending time with you, how will you react? Will you say, yes, it was fun last time, I learned so much about myself and now I feel so safe with this person? Or would you maybe not have so much fun? Or even worry that this time something might come up that you will like even less? Will you maybe be even stressed inside or scared? Would we still do what our friend or our mother asks us to do? That would certainly depend on whether we have a choice. If we had a good life and wouldn't need them, we can just say, no, thank you. But if we know we can't leave because we are maybe financially or emotionally dependent, for example, then the situation might look different. Maybe we will then go with them again and hope for the best. Well, now a similar situation, but a different constellation. Your friend picks you up and wants to walk over hot coal today. You are, as before, very nervous and don't want to burn your feet. But now this friend would show you how he walks over the hot coal. He would laugh and it would seem he has a lot of fun. He would show you his feet and you would see that they're not burned. Maybe you would then become even curious in this fun and relaxed situation and also try to walk over the coal. Or you would decide that it makes no sense for you at all to walk over the hot coal, but your friend would be completely okay with that and would be just happy that you were there and that you had fun with him while he tried. How would that feel? Different? We were confronted with something that scares us in both cases, but this time, instead of being pressured and without a choice, we would have the experience at our own pace. We could decide if we wanted to participate at all and if so, to what extent. Could it then be that the moment when we voluntarily decide to walk over the coal would feel like a moment of personal triumph? As a moment in which we were allowed to make the decision for ourselves to be brave, but also where we could say no for good without any consequences, where it would be completely okay not to do it because it's just too much for us at the moment. Or maybe we see absolutely no need to force ourselves through it because it's just not our thing. And that the no would have no consequences and that our friend would still like us just as much as before. And would we then, the next time we see this friend again, maybe even look forward to which idea he has this time? Wouldn't that be real trust? That you know you can say no without emotional or physical consequences? That you can go at your own pace and only do the things that either are fun for you or really unavoidable? In the example with the mother, where we just had to do the things that were exhausting and made no sense to us, maybe a little positive feedback could help. But this situation is a little different anyway, and I will talk about this at a different time. Now the question is, what is trust really, and how is it created? At its core, our sense of trust comes from two components: self-confidence and trust in our abilities, and trust in others. Ultimately, we all want an environment that is characterized by trust and mutual respect. But is this realistic? Despite the advantages of mutual trust, our everyday life is often different. Our interaction is characterized by power games, competition, blame, and sometimes more, sometimes less hidden hostility. And the less trust in others a person has, the more the need for control develops. Because if you had absolute control over another being, be it your partner, children, or in our case, our horses, trust would be unnecessary. And trust, which we have often learned throughout our lives, is not always appropriate. But the problem is, you can never control everything. At the very least, you can never control the feelings and the needs of another being. And the other problem with control is that it does the opposite of what it is intended to do. The more we feel controlled, the more we look for ways to escape it. Every living being needs its personal space, and the more the space is restricted, the stronger is the need to break out. To break free, we sometimes use methods that may cause even more distrust and can lead to increased attempts to control from the one who controls. The vicious cycle is closed. In case of our horses, however, it is often not possible for them to escape. Some may try. They might try to calm you down by showing appeasement signs, or they might resist and fight or get really slow with responding. But if the signs are ignored, a feeling of inner helplessness and hopelessness will develop in them. Unfortunately, these are the horses that we actually want. They hardly react to external stimuli and are, so to speak, bomb-proof. How do we lose trust? Here is a brief list of how we undermine or even destroy the trust of others, but also that of our horses. We do not keep promises. We only have our own advantage in mind and don't consider the other side. We avoid compromises and maximize only our own advantage. We want to control everything and always. We cannot let others just try out something. Our energy, what we say and what we do contradicts each other. We blame others for things that go wrong. We criticize more than we praise. And we rarely give positive feedback. We make decisions alone and do not allow the other being to participate. We underestimate the strengths and talents of others. We don't encourage or support others in their development because we are only interested in ourselves. We never ask for advice or help. We function almost like a machine, always the same and show little emotion. Any form or refusal of our requests is seen as a form of personal criticism or questioning of our personality, and we strike back accordingly. We try to avoid discussions and play down conflicts of any kind. We do not reflect on or even apologize for mistakes, misunderstandings, or bad behavior. How can we now rebuild trust that we can trust others again and others can trust us? Being able to trust others is a skill that, as mentioned before, is developed in early childhood, and the extent on how much we can trust is based on the experiences we made. A person who was able to build up healthy basic trust as an infant and who has also made the experience of reliability and sincerity of his caregivers in later childhood will find it easier to build trust in other people as an adult than a person who has had the experience again and again that others cannot be relied upon. But even if you had no one to trust as a child, it is still possible to learn trust. Here are the 5 basic rules of trust. Number 1. Communicate at eye level, not from a superior position, so that the other person understands you. Nothing creates and maintains trust as much as being with each other regularly and openly. In the case of our horses, this would mean learning horse language and communicating clearly and peacefully. Number 2. Be authentic. Only communicate what you mean, believe, feel, and act accordingly. This is a basic principle of authenticity or trustworthiness. Number 3. Don't do or say something when you're not 100% behind it, or something that is not in line with your values. In our everyday lives, we may not be able to say everything, but before we lie or do something that is not in accordance with our values, it's better to not say or do anything. If it happens anyway, it's a good idea to reflect on the situation afterwards and to think about how to solve the situation differently in the future. Of course, this is especially true when interacting with our horses. Number 4. Accept the situations that did not go as planned. If you notice in the moment that, for example, you do something with your horse that you didn't want to do anymore, just take a step back, take a deep breath, and think about how to continue best. Making mistakes is not a problem, but it would be a bummer if you would not learn from them for the next time. Number 5. Take your time. Trust cannot be built in a day. And at some point, you need somewhat of a real-life test to consolidate the bond. Trust is good, but a real-life proof is better, and the effect will be much longer lasting. Beyond these 5 points, there are a few more things that strengthen and promote mutual trust. 1 is openness to suggestions that the horse has and to encourage it to come up with its own ideas and to make decisions. This will help the horse to find its inner strength. Then, of course, honesty in regard to your own intentions. This means not pretending that you have something else in mind and then unexpectedly, for example, give a dewormer. Rather, show openly what you have in mind, even if it takes longer. And if it doesn't work right away, then you can still work with positive reinforcement for a while. And finally, take a real interest in your horse, especially how it lives outside of the time you spend together. For example, does it have enough freedom, an interesting environment, friends, and enough forage? Building trust between us and our horse can take a while, especially if the horse was controlled a lot before. It can also mean that we might have to take a look at ourselves and our other relationships in our life, and to take our time to heal from past experiences and to grow as a person. And while we take care of ourselves, we can give the horse the time and space to trust us again, so that it learns that life with us can be fun and exciting. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast episode. If something of what I said sounds interesting and you would like to learn more about it, I'd like to invite you to my website, peopleandhorsesinoneword.com, or my Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter account for more info. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful day with your horse.